Hi.
Okay. Questions before we start? Announcements, Talia? Yes. Do you want the mic?
Plagiarism.
Actually, not. If you're using Bronfenbrenner's hypotheses and quoting them, put them in quotes and put at the end which hypothesis it is. You don't need to say, don't attribute them to me, actually. They are all quotes from Bronfenbrenner. If you were going to do that, in a formal paper, just in case you run into the situation again, when you're taking a quotation from another source, you cite the original author, so it would be Bronfenbrenner in Shelton, in this case. So it would be, you would attribute it to Bronfenbrenner, but then indicate where you got it. The other thing you can do with Bronfenbrenner is go back to the original and cite his 1979 book, if that's where it came from. Yes? For Bronfenbrenner from my book, only if you have, you know, two or more. Otherwise, you can just put a footnote at the end. We're not. I know. I'm letting you get away with sloppy scholarship, and my colleagues will shoot me. But I'd rather you spent time on the content and the thinking rather than making sure that the citations are in proper form. Other questions? Okay. The next order of business then is to figure out whether or not you want review sessions before the final exam. Our last class is on a Wednesday in May, I believe, like the 2nd. And our exam is on Friday the 4th. Heck! The first day of exams. And it's at 11:45 in the morning on Friday the 4th. That's in the syllabus. So, therefore, we have very limited time between the last class and the exam to do review sessions. I can, if you would like, schedule one immediately after the last class. I can schedule something on Thursday. I don't think it's effective to have one on Friday morning before the exam. You wouldn't be there anyway. So, how many of you would like one and would stay after class on Wednesday, the last class? Okay. You will take notes, Talia. I'll make the reservations. And on Thursday, how many of you would like one on Thursday? Would you like it in the morning? In the evening? Can't believe I said that. I have something on my calendar that afternoon. I'm trying to remember. I have a committee meeting. Okay, I could do it at noon or one on Thursday. 4 on Thursday. Evening on Thursday. I need a visual signal here. How many of you would come to a review session Thursday evening? Friday at 4. I mean Thursday at 4. Friday at 4, the exam will be over. Okay. Noon on Thursday. No, there are no classes on that Thursday. That's the reading day. Okay. Well, I'll definitely do one Thursday evening, and then we'll negotiate one during the day. Okay. Thank you. You do remember that when we changed the time for this class to an hour later, we also changed the exam date. It was originally scheduled the last day of exams, and it switched to the first day of exams. So, and a couple of you might be taking HDFS 5 in the fall. That will have its exam on the last day of exams before Christmas. Registrar does it. Question? Yeah. The 6-ish or 6:30-ish? Anything else? You're all happy campers. Or numb and stunned. Okay. All right. Let me go back to Galinsky and talk about the changes that take place for parents as children grow up. We were, I think, just about wrapped up with the authority stage, and I had made points such as this comes about because children start getting mobile and they can get into more difficulty. Children begin to develop a desire to do things on their own, which can create messes. Yes? Yeah, eventually. I just wanted everybody to know it was the authority stage. And these are on the web, or will be, so you don't need to copy things down frantically. Okay. And as the child's abilities expand, the child becomes capable of doing more, it's necessary for parents to begin to wrestle with the issue of whether or not they set limits on what the child can do. Because if you don't, you can be in big trouble. And the point that Galinsky makes is that many parents find this to be quite a contrast from the nurturing stage, when you just give them this unconditional love and they're happy and they gurgle and coo, and they don't stomp their feet and say, "Mommy, I hate you," or "No," and set up the battle of wills that is likely to happen when kids start becoming mobile and willful. The difficulty that many parents have is that they aren't comfortable being authorities. They're not comfortable exercising authority. So they make a mess of it. Some of them avoid setting limits, and they raise children that we all don't like to room with when we get to college. They raise children who don't have limits and don't understand adhering to limits. Or the parents are uncomfortable and raise children who are suppressed, oppressed, who don't have an opportunity to explore the world, who aren't allowed to test their own skills because the parents make all of their decisions for them and tell them what to do and expect them to obey. So obviously there's a problem with too much authority on one end, not enough on the other, and where you want to be raising children is comfortably in the middle, so that you let kids stretch their wings and try things out, but in a controlled fashion. So you want the child to become self-regulating, but that takes time, it's not automatic, and it takes skillful guidance as you help kids figure out how to think about their activities and teach them what they need to think about before they do it. And some parents don't like the idea of restricting children. Some parents don't like the fact that this is a major responsibility and you have to carry it out, or people like me will criticize you because I don't want to live next to your kids. I don't want your kids in class. I don't want them dating my children or leading my children astray if you haven't taught them to be thoughtful and considerate and sensible. But some parents find it extremely difficult when a kid looks at them and says, "I hate you." The responsible parent says, "That's the way it is. You know, you can hate me if you want. I'm not going to take that personally. My responsibility as a parent is to make sure that you grow up able to be in society rather than locked up. Therefore, you will do it my way, and if you want to earn the right to do it your way, then you do that in a reasonable way. And my job is to help you to do that. And I love you, and I will reward your efforts. I'm not going to punish you to the point where you lose your spirit. I'm not going to hurt you, but I am going to hurt your little ego at times because I'm going to restrict what you're permitted to do." And that's a reasonable approach. We call it an authoritative approach, because I know as a parent that I'm the adult and I have to be the adult. The kid deserves to have an adult or two, needs to have an adult or two, and because I had the child, it's my job. So I'm stuck with it. The images that get us into trouble are the images that we've grown up with and that have been sometimes reinforced during the nurturing stage, that there's no anger. You're not supposed to be angry with kids. And they certainly shouldn't be angry with you. Many of us have the view that parenting should be giving kids unconditional love. Good luck. It is unconditional, but it's not you can do anything you want. Some of us have difficulty with our children being different from us. We want them to be like us. Accepting people who are different is a major challenge for us. It's one of the problems between men and women in relationships. It's very difficult to accept that the other sex is legitimately different from us, and they're not going to be like us. They're not going to think like we are, and they're not going to feel like we do, and that's the way it is. And we can work out a good relationship, but we have to accept at the beginning, or somewhere along the line if it's going to survive, we have to accept that the other person is different and has a right to be different. That applies to children. Children will be different from their parents. And sometimes they will be different in ways that annoy the heck out of us, that they are different from us. parents are sometimes forced to acknowledge that they have given birth to somebody else's child. A child that's possessed. A child that is imperfect. Couldn't possibly be mine. On the other hand, it looks just like you and has all your faults, so it probably is you, yours. And you have to learn to deal with a child that you never thought you would be raising. Child with disabilities, child with a temperament that is very different from yours, a child who doesn't think the way you do, a child who has very different skills and interests than you have. And as a parent, your challenge is to parent that child as if that child were the best kid in the whole world. And that, for some people, is a long-term readjustment of the image. We'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. The other images that we have are that children are always nice, and that children won't change. Children constantly change. That's the point of the book. And the microsystem and the relationships within it are constantly shifting to accommodate the changing talents, skills, interests, and needs and potentials of the child. And occasionally you get to acknowledge that the parents are changing too. The skills that are needed in this period, establishing and enforcing limits in a reasonable way, trying to understand the child, avoiding battles of will. You can't win with a four-year-old. You can't win with a three-year-old. They can outweigh you forever. So you don't get into battles of will. You set the limits, you enforce the limits. There is no battle if you're comfortable being the authority. And then you have to keep changing. As I said at the beginning of this conversation a couple of classes ago, the difficulty with parenting is that kids keep changing and you hit a plateau where everybody's comfortable. You get to enjoy that for a little bit and then the child changes and there you are again. Among the issues, and there are many, one is being an authority comfortably with another parent. And two parents may have quite different backgrounds to bring to the parenting process. We've talked about the reality that you have different developmental backgrounds. You've been in different microsystems. You had different relationships with your parents. And you bring those now into parenting the same child, and you have to figure out how to create two relationships, one with mother, one with father, with the child, and have those be appropriate without destroying the relationship between the parents because they differ. We often see our partners in new ways that we hadn't anticipated when they're trying to parent a kid who may be difficult for them to parent. Another issue is mentoring the child. How do you, in fact, teach a child to behave appropriately? Announcing what you want is insufficient. You can't just tell a three-year-old, I want you to behave, don't make any problems. You have to be much more specific about that, and you have to make sure that the child understands and can carry out each of the activities that you want the child to engage in. Behavior, living in the world, is a very complex motor activity. And none of us get it and learn that activity in appropriate ways just by being told to behave appropriately. You have to teach what is appropriate. You have to model what is appropriate. And that is a very complex motor activity for the parent. But some parents act as if, just behave. Why don't you behave? And they're not teaching the child what the child needs to know. So being an authoritative parent means having a curriculum for parenting, knowing what you want the child to be able to do, knowing when the child is able to learn it, and then teaching it. And they don't require a license for this. They don't require you to pass a test that says you know how to parent. Then you have to figure out who else is going to take care of your child. Child care, preschool, who else gets to do it, what are their rules, can the child live up to their expectations, and how do you feel about their expectations? Yeah. I just, before class, had a wonderful conversation with my daughter, the pediatrician in New Mexico, who had been to her daughter's school. They're doing physiology, and she and her husband are both teaching the third and fourth graders. So she was doing the ear, and her husband had just come back talking about how he had managed to handle the three little boys in the class who are totally uncontrolled. All the rest of the kids are just fine. They're very curious, and they do whatever you ask them to do. But the teacher turns out to be unable to manage, and through the course of the year, she has not managed to shape the behavior of these three little boys in the classroom. And so my daughter and her husband have been having some difficulty with that. And it's not unusual for parents and teachers to differ in their expectations for kids and their expectations for each other about what you're supposed to do for your child. So when kids misbehave, particularly if they misbehave in school, there's a predictable kind of response to that. Teachers will blame the parents, and parents will blame the teachers. Working out a relationship with the teachers where you both agree on the approach is very difficult. But when you give your children over to the care of other people, your expectation is that you can find a place where your children will grow up the way you want them to. But that's not always possible. And then there's the button pusher for parents. What do you do with the 2.5-year-old who's masturbating in public, the little girl who has her hand in her underpants, the kids who are curious about sexuality and ask in inappropriate places? And that turns out to be one of the difficult topics for parents to deal with. How do you set limits on your kids' physical expression, particularly when it's in the sexual realm? And the community may have different standards for public behavior than you have at home. You can explore that one. Now, complications for parents. What's difficult? These are things that are touched on in Galinsky, and I've given you a couple of readings that elaborate on them. One of the difficulties that begins to emerge in the authority stage and then continues is that kids don't come at you all the same. They come at you hardwired to respond to the world in different ways, and we call that temperament. So some kids have high activity level. Some kids have low activity. Some kids are very negatively reactive. Other kids are just fine and smile all the time. Some kids are very difficult to change. If you change the schedule, it takes them weeks to get with the program. Other kids, you can just say, well, we're going to change the schedule, and they say, okay, well, that's a nice new adventure. And temperament affects the parenting dyad with the child. The parent's child with the dyad is shaped not only by the developmental characteristics of the child, but by the temperament of the child. So I gave you an article by Chess, Thomas, and Birch, and Galinsky reproduces in her book the 9 characteristics of temperament that Chess, Thomas, and Birch have tried to measure over many years. These were characteristics of babies and young children that they found they could measure, they could see differences in kids fairly reliably. and this research has been going on for the last half century. Activity level, rhythmicity or regularity, approach or withdrawal, adaptability, the threshold of responsiveness, intensity of the reaction, quality of the mood, whether it's negative or positive, distractibility, and attention span and persistence. Now, these characteristics come in different clusters. Some of them we call easy babies. Some of them they call slow to warm up. Some of them they call challenging or difficult, because if you have a kid who has a high activity level and a low threshold of arousal, so it doesn't take much to get the kid up and moving, and the mood is negative and the kid is resistant to new things, that makes parenting difficult. Some of you have parents like that. Some of you were like that. Hopefully none of you will ever have a partner who is a difficult child. It's an important thing to know about your partner. Ask his or her parents. And hopefully you'll never have a child who is like that. The reality is that some 20 to 25% of children are. And it appears to be pretty much built in. Some aspects of temperament are clearly physiological. And children, for example, who are going to be shy have particular characteristics that, in transaction with the parental behavior, may become quite shy. But parents can shift the child's responses, not by changing the physiology, but by accommodating the physiology enough so that they're not constantly making the kid upset. Particularly with difficult or slow to warm up children, it's possible for parents to continually frustrate them. And it's mutual. The kids are constantly frustrating the parent. But if you approach the child knowing that the child has some cluster of these characteristics, you can adapt your parenting so that you're helpful to the child instead of constantly frustrating the child. Now, Chess, Thomas, and Birch describe easy and difficult and slow to warm up children with these clusters. You can find these in any developmental textbook. And they're fairly well described in the chapter that you have. In the chapter that you have, we've gone beyond looking at what the temperaments are to looking at the parenting challenges that these present. So you have easy children are the ones you want to get. They're self-regulating, it's hard to upset them, they recover quickly, they're reasonable, they're even-tempered, you want one of those, you want two or three of those. And you want a kid who's not like the difficult or challenging child. The difficult child doesn't like changes, doesn't like new things at first. They may adapt to them eventually. They're irregular in their patterns. Think about the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities in the microsystem. These kids are pushing that microsystem pattern differently than an easy child will. It's much easier to develop a stable microsystem pattern with an easy child than it is with a challenging or difficult child. Changes in the microsystem pattern are more difficult with a difficult child. So think about having a kid whose sleep patterns are regular, who eats and defecates at the same time every day, who entertains himself fairly well, and doesn't get upset if anything in the environment is changed. Then contrast that with what happens with the challenging child, whose reaction to any change is likely to be negative at first. The kid is more easily upset. Sleep patterns are irregular, so the kid falls asleep one night at 7 o'clock and the next night it's 10 o'clock. And there you are trying to adapt to that, trying to make a consistent pattern. And the kid gets fussy about eating as he or she grows up. So you go through this period of, I won't eat, anything that looks, acts, or smells like a vegetable. Period. In fact, I will eat nothing that doesn't look like a Cheerio. And if it tastes like a Cheerio and looks like a Cheerio and behaves like a Cheerio, then I'm fine. Thank you very much. Don't give me anything new. That's difficult to cater to. We eventually want kids to be like the dog. They'll eat anything that you put in front of them. Table food. The challenging or difficult child also recovers slowly when you upset it, so it stays upset longer. If you have to set limits, this challenging child doesn't like limits in the first place, will tell you so strenuously, will continue to tell you so, and will continue to challenge those limits much longer than the easy child will. The easy child says, oh, okay, I can see the purpose of that. I don't mind changing my behavior. As long as it pleases you, Mom and Dad, it's okay. I want to be a good kid, and I am a good kid, so I'm going to go with the flow here. I'm going to get with the program and fit in with the microsystem pattern that you would like and maintain a positive dyadic relationship with both of you. We love those kids. And then the difficult kid comes along and says, no, that's not the way I want it. I'm sorry. I don't care whether you like me or not. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to continue to do it my way. And we're going to butt heads on this for as long as you insist that I do it your way, because I refuse to do it your way. And if you force me to, I'm going to throw a conniption fit. One of my favorites from looking at kids was one of those difficult kids who was having difficulty with his parents' divorce. His sister went off to college, and living with one parent who wanted to make some changes in the house. And this 14-year-old did not want those changes to be made because they meant that the divorce was real and he was going to have to accept it. So every time the parent tried to make some kind of change in the house, the kid would change it back. And they got into what they eventually called the Great Wastebasket Battle. Whether the wastebasket in the dining room, which the parent had never liked in the dining room, wastebaskets should be in the kitchen, you don't need one in the dining room. So the parent had moved it to the kitchen, and day after day after day, it returned to the dining room. They were both fairly difficult people, and went on for months, and they finally resolved it. But the battle became the microsystem pattern and the defining feature of their dyadic relationship, which was negative, full of conflict, reciprocal conflict as it developed, and neither of them was a happy camper in that situation. What happens then is, as Chess and Thomas describe it in the book, that the chapter that you have, what we're looking for is what they call goodness of fit. And that exists when, this is a quote from that chapter, goodness of fit exists when the demands and expectations of the parents and other people important in the child's life are compatible with the child's temperament and abilities and other characteristics. Compatible. When you have that kind of fit, when the expectations that we have for the child are compatible, then the child can continue to develop. But when we have what they call poorness of fit, a crappy fit, the demands and expectations don't fit what the child can do, and the child is likely to be stressed. The parents are also likely to be stressed. And the dyadic relationships in the family are likely to have a negative tilt to them. Power is likely to be at issue, and the microsystem pattern is likely to have to accommodate the power struggle that parents get into when they're trying to make the child be and do as the child can't. Now, that doesn't mean that you're supposed to let your child dictate what happens. That's not what goodness of fit means for them. Goodness of fit means for them that you have an understanding of what the child's characteristics are, and you take those into account so that you shape the child's behavior in ways that don't stress the child as much as might happen otherwise. You're making it better. You're not accommodating the child so that the child is running the household. You're helping the child learn in appropriate ways. But you understand how to do that, and you understand that with a difficult child particularly, you have to go slowly. You have to give the child lots of warning if you're going to change things. You have to have the child participate in decisions and problem solving as much as possible. And you can't have the big argument every day, because that's going to stress everyone. One of the easiest tips for those of you who work with difficult children is that you learn not to take their negativity and their negative response to new things or to limits personally. So you say, well, I'm sorry, we can't do that. I know we said we would go to the movie, but your little sister, your big sister is sick. We can't go. It's not fair to take her out. She has 102 fever. So we're not going to the movie. We'll do something else. But it has to be something at home. And the kid says, no! Okay. The accommodating parent with goodness of fit anticipated the no, and you let it go. Okay. Well, you can figure out what you want to do at home. You know, we don't have to decide right now, but think about the things you'd like us to do, because we do have to spend the evening at home, and that's, you know, I'm sorry, just the way it is. I hate you. Okay, well, when you stop hating me, let's figure out something we'd like to do. What you hear is the parent not taking the no personally and understanding that the kid needs to do that and doesn't mean anything. Yeah. So it's not disrespectful for a difficult child to be, it's not disrespectful to that child to just not pay much attention to the initial negative response, because what experience tells you is that after the kid thinks it over, the kid will come up and you'll have a great evening. The kid will come up with something to do, come back to you, say, okay, well, can we play this? And you say, yeah, okay, that's great, you know, we'll do that, and we'll have a good time. What parents who are not doing a good job of creating a good fit will do in that situation is when the kid says, no, I don't want to do anything, and terrible, you suck, the parent takes that personally and gets into a battle. Okay, now the kid's being disrespectful to the parent. So the kid is going to end up in his room all evening. Everybody's going to be miserable because the parent is taking that initial reflex negativity personally and seriously, rather than saying, okay, the kid is always going to pop off. And eventually, by the time the kid is a teenager, he or she's going to learn to hold his tongue. But at 5 or 4, that's not going to happen. The tongue is way out there ahead of the mind, and so you don't make a big deal out of it. Later you can say, you know, maybe next time you could not call me names when you're telling me you don't want to do that, but I'm glad you came around quickly, and I really like you, and we're having a great time. Does that difference make sense? Some of you have dealt with difficult kids. Some of you are difficult kids. Some of you have difficult parents. Okay, so goodness of fit means that you anticipate and understand the kid's initial reaction and what you need to go beyond that so that you can teach what you need to teach. What you're doing, okay, is creating a dyadic relationship that takes into account the individual characteristics of each child. And as you do that, you're allowing for more positive affect, greater reciprocity, a greater balance of power, more joint molar activities, more complex activities, and thus everybody's developing. If you don't take into account the kid's temperament and figure out how to deal with that, then you're going to end up in a negative affective power struggle, and you're going to focus on the major power struggle as your primary dyadic activity with the child, your joint activity, and nobody's going to learn anything beyond how to manipulate or fight, and you don't want that to happen as your primary joint activity with your kids. You don't want that to get real complex. Particularly if you have a challenging child, the parental skills that are required are important and they are complex. It's easier to raise easy children. You don't have to think about it an awful lot. Challenging children require that you really understand who your kid is and have a repertoire of behaviors for dealing with the child, and a lot of emotional maturity so that you don't get into the fist fights with your 10-year-old. Okay, moving on with the next stage in Galinsky. We have what she calls the interpretive stage. This is the longest stage. And it's the stage when she describes it, as she describes it, the parents are going to be interpreting the world to the child, helping the child develop a valid and differentiated view of the world that they live in. That requires adult interaction with the child. You need a dyadic interaction with the child in which the adult can share activities and provide understanding and language reciprocally so that the child has an opportunity to think about the experience the child is having, so that somebody is helping the child understand the experiences the child is having and teaching the skills the child needs to use the knowledge in the real world with other people. What does that require? It requires that you have a reasonably valid view of the world yourself, that you have an articulate understanding of the way the world works, and you can help the child come to understand that. And that's not always easy. Not only do you have to interpret yourself to your child, the child to the child, but yourself, and you have to figure out where to get the information that they need and that you need so that you can understand the experience that they're having. Now, there's some classic situations that we often fall back on when we're thinking about what does this mean for parents to interpret. One of the ones that I like to talk about is a classic literature on how we prepare children for school. When you think about having a child going off to school, preschool or kindergarten, what is it the parent says to the child that will help the child move into and succeed in the school setting? This has been studied by a number of people who just go into homes and or into labs and have parents talk to their children about what school is going to be like and think about what does your child need to know. And what you see is there are a wide range of approaches, some of which are not terribly helpful to children. One of the approaches is that you want your kid to be good, so you tell the child, as you prepare it for school, that it's very important not to upset teachers. It's very important to mind. You're supposed to be a good child. You're supposed to be obedient. Don't make any trouble. So when you get to school, keep your mouth shut. And the kid goes to school and keeps his mouth shut and doesn't learn very much to try and figure out how to be good. And you're not teaching the skills that are really useful in school. Another parent will approach it quite differently. Okay, you're going to school. It's really important to ask all the questions that occur to you. If you don't understand something, be sure to ask the teacher. The teacher is there to help you understand, and so she wants to hear what your questions are. So don't be shy. The teacher is the person you can rely on. If you have any problem, you go to the teacher, you talk to the teacher, she'll be the one who will help you. The emphasis then is not on staying out of trouble. The emphasis is on learning and taking initiative and approaching the teacher and an expectation that the teacher will be helpful rather than the teacher is going to watch for you doing something bad, so you need to hide from the teacher any behavior that the teacher might think of as bad, and we're not going to give you enough information so you'll know what's bad behavior. So one child gets a valid and fairly differentiated view that's going to be useful, and the other child gets a view that is going to make the kid a bump on the log sitting in kindergarten, not asking questions. Okay. You can go on with your own variations on that theme. It's one of the examples where parents have the job of helping their children understand the situations they're going to get in. One of the fun characteristics of this stage is that as kids get into the interpretive stage, they have lots of questions. Some of you have worked with those kids or babysat those kids or have little brothers and sisters who have a zillion questions. Who is God? Why can't I play with myself in public? Why does that woman look so fat? Why do you drink so much? And on and on and on. The problem for many of us is that we don't have the answers. We want to help the child frame questions and answer them, but not so that they embarrass us in public. Sometimes we don't know where to get the answers. And as kids get older, they're often asking questions that we're very unsure about ourselves. That will happen even more as they move into adolescence and ask questions that appear to challenge our beliefs and our values as they begin to establish themselves as people who are going to be adults. This is a process that changes parents. Discovering what you don't know. Why does it rain? Why is the sky blue? Where does the sun go at night? Why did it snow in the middle of April? What's global warming? The wonderful thing about teaching educators, early childhood educators in elementary, is that you can anticipate that everything a kid could possibly want to know about the natural world and science will be asked. And most of us don't have a clue how to answer it. Now, until we take the science education course or do a lot of reading about kids' questions and how to answer them. And one of the things that happens for us is that we lose face. We lose our standing with kids if we can't either answer the question or help them come up with the answer. And eventually get to the point where you're not going to know the answers, so the relationship that you establish with the child is a guiding relationship. I will help you find the information that you need. We will find somebody to ask who knows. And it's okay for me not to know. I don't have to know everything. I don't even have to know the simple things. Well, I studied that in school once, but I forgot. So now we'll move on. What kinds of problems come up in this kind of, in this stage? One is that some parents have to know everything and be right, so they make up bullshit to tell their kids. And their kids are getting this information that is invalid. Some parents develop the style when they don't know anything, they make fun of the kid's question. So kids learn not to ask their parents, because their parents are going to belittle them or say, well, that's a stupid question to ask. And they are creating a problem in the relationship, which will eventually reduce the number of reciprocal activities they can engage in, because the kid is going to figure out that the parent doesn't know anything and doesn't respect the question. One of the things we learn as teachers is to help kids, you, anybody else, figure out where the answers might be or who might know them, but we don't make fun of the question. Any question is legitimate. So now we can explore it. Some parents have difficulty with that. So some kids learn not to ask questions, and if that's persistent, then they come to school with no curiosity. They've stopped wondering about things. And then it's very hard to get that back when kids have stopped wondering about things, because their parents haven't encouraged them to think. They don't wonder, they don't have curiosity, they don't pursue information and knowledge on their own. And that's hard to get back. All kids are curious. And you can nurture it and feed it so that the kid becomes a lifelong learner by the time he's four. But you have to nurture that. You nurture the questions, and you nurture extending the questions and exploring and speculating and then finding out, developing that valid view, but also developing the skill, the motivation and the skill to learn more about the world. And you can tell a kid who's come from a family that does that, because the kid continues to have endless questions and continues to want to learn in any situation. And they're the ones we all love to teach. Some of the issues that Galinsky talks about are interpreting yourself as a parent. You have to figure out what kind of parent you want to be, and being able to explain that to your child. How do you do that? When does that come up? One of the approaches that parents take that's interpretive is interpreting themselves and the child and the family so that the kid understands how you're supposed to behave. Many of us have difficulty with kids when they squabble, they fight, they're unkind to each other or to the parents. And that requires interpretation. So you establish a view of the family and of the child and as of the parent that helps the child understand that this is not the way we behave. So one of my favorite lines is, we don't do that in our family. Other people do that. We don't talk to each other that way in our family. It's just simply not permitted. We don't do that. You want to be in this family, you don't behave that way. It's not appropriate. You don't belittle other people. You're not sarcastic with people. You don't call each other names. You don't steal each other's stuff. You don't take stuff without asking. You don't hit each other. All of those things are behavioral expectations. They are in many ways limits, but they are also an interpretation for the child of what it means to be a member of this family. People who love each other don't treat each other that way. Please talk to me as if I were somebody you love. Those are interpretations of the expectations within the family. And then you can reinforce those. If you're explaining to kids, you're interpreting to kids what is appropriate, then they can rely on that in their own interactions and they can build on it. But if you're the parent who doesn't know what your expectations are, you don't have an interpretation of your family, it's hard to help the kid develop the kind of view that is going to guide the child's behavior. You're interpreting them to themselves. You're beginning to understand and accept that the child has knowledge that you don't and questions that you can't answer, and accepting that the child's view of the world is going to be quite different from yours. Some of us would love to share all of our knowledge with our children, but we forget that they're at a very different stage of understanding. So the interpretation has to be at their level and then build them toward adulthood, but that's a slow process. So some of us have difficulty in seeing ourselves as interpreters and understanding how to put across with children our interpretations of the world in ways that they can deal with, that they can understand. You decide how involved to be in your child's life, how much to engage in activities. Do you share your activities with the child? Do you change your activities so that you can be part of the child's activities and make those joint activities? If you're a person who loves activities the kids can't really engage in, do you cut back on those as a parent? How do you establish yourself as a participant in the child's life in a way that doesn't suck you into being a kid and also doesn't require the child to be an adult? Where's that compromise? How do you share your interests and activities? It's easy for some of us because we like playing games and having fun and being foolish and exploring new things. Others of us as parents have much more difficulty with that. Some of us don't do very well with our kids until they're teenagers and can share our activities. By then you may not have much chance to get them involved in yours because you don't have a history of that. And one of the challenges in interpreting the world to the child is helping the child get ready for whatever's going to come in adolescence and preparing yourself for that. Not as often happens when I do workshops or talk with parents on development, particularly in adolescence. One of the things that really offends me, I find it very difficult to deal with, is parents who stand in front of their kids or they're engaged in a conversation with another adult like me and their kids, and they're telling me they really hate to think of their kids becoming teenagers because it's going to be such hell. So here's the kid getting the parent's interpretation of adolescence, which is that it's going to be terrible. And so there's the kid saying, oh, okay, so adolescence is really going to be terrible. Gee, that makes me feel good. And my parents don't understand it. They're telling this guy that. And they don't want me to be a teenager. So how do I avoid doing that? Can I stop the clock and not be a teenager? I've heard parents say they wish they could put their kids in suspended animation until they're 18. The kid's listening to that. So what's the message? My parents don't want to have anything to do with me for that 6 or 7 year period. Yeah. What kind of dyadic relationship are we setting up with that kind of interpretation of the teenage years? I usually try to help the kids and model for the parents. I love teenagers. I think it's a really neat period of time. They learn so many new things, and they become curious about new things, and it's fun to watch them develop different kinds of friendships and start having romantic relationships, and I can talk to them much more about things that are really important in adulthood, and they'll make you think about all those things that you haven't thought about, because they're going to ask questions about those, and it's just so much fun to watch them move toward adulthood. And the parents and the kids look at me like, huh? Huh? What about drugs? Well, you know, if you expect your kids to do drugs, maybe they will, but maybe if you expect them not to and have them involved in other things, they will at least be moderate in their use of drugs. The thoughts about the interpretive stage, looking forward to it? How did your parents do with it? Did you learn a lot from your parents when you were 8 and 9? Did your parents give you opportunities to learn from people who had interesting things? They send you to camp? Did they involve you in groups? Did they involve you in activities? Did they talk to you about really important stuff? So the parent is able to interpret things now and encourage you.
Yeah.
Other observations? You looking forward to interpreting the world to your kids? Or the kids in your class? For some of you? Who needs the needs? You know. You all have needs as you grew up? It's Dr. Seuss thing. What?
What?
Needs.
Oh.
Needs. You remember reading about needs?
Yeah.
A wonderful way to help kids understand about resources and running out of resources and greed and all that kind of stuff. You interpret the children's books that you read when you do child care. Make sure they have the books that will let you talk about the really important topics with them. Any of you have interpretive parents who took all the fun out of life because they were so serious about it? That's a problem too. Parents who want to interpret everything bad in the world about to their children and tell them about all the problems that are happening, and it's depressing after a while. Part of the issue is, what do you explain to kids how and when? When do they need to learn about something? Sometimes you don't have any choice. There they are. You have to interpret it because they're exposed to things in the real world that are unpleasant. Other times, you get to pick and choose. When do you teach about the birds and the bees? Hey, let's take a quick romp back through Bronfenbrenner. You have the reading on discovering what families do and the parent-child relationship. And I pulled out the propositions in those four, you, particularly the 1990 article, where he tries to put this together. What does this really mean if we're going to raise children and think about what it takes In order to develop, a child requires participation in progressively more complex reciprocal activity. On a regular basis over an extended period in the child's life. Not just once, not just on the weekend, but over and over and over again, things that can grow. With one or more persons with whom the child develops a strong, mutually rational, emotional attachment and is committed to the child's well-being and development, preferably for life. What does that mean about temperament if you have a kid who's difficult to love? Where does a kid get somebody who has a strong, mutually rational, emotional attachment? That ought to happen in the nurturing stage. Here's this little baby. And then it ought to continue. Here's this kid who I'm teaching through the authority stage. Here's this kid I'm sharing my world with and interpreting the world to, and whose questions fascinate me, and who's the smartest little kid that ever was. I'm irrational about that, and I'm committed to the child's well-being and development. What Galinsky is describing for us is that it's not always easy. Some of us have difficulty with the emotional attachment piece. Some of us have difficulty having strong mutual attachment with a child because the child is very different from us. Some of us have difficulty with the irrational attachment because it's difficult for us to give. It's difficult for us to put ourselves out and take into account somebody else's experience. It's difficult for us to put aside what we might be interested in and tackle what the child is interested in and help the child understand it. Bronfenbrenner also suggests that when we do establish the pattern of progressive interpersonal interaction, it enhances the young child's responsiveness to other features of the immediate physical, social, and symbolic, that means the print and film and art environment, that it invite exploration. So if you're going to have the child develop a valid view of the world that he or she lives in, the child has to be interested in it and exploring it. It's the parent's responsibility to start that off so that interest in the world is nurtured by the parent and shared by the parent. When you have that strong mutual attachment early on and engage the child in reciprocal interactions, you're creating that ongoing curiosity and exploration of the world. You have to set, again, limits around that so that the child learns the skills to explore the world in an appropriate way. And you create imagination by sharing in the child's fantasies. If you don't engage in those joint activities, the child is not going to develop the kind of curiosity and creative imagination that we want children to have. The parent is in the perfect position to do that, or to make sure that the child has opportunities to be with adults who can nurture their intellectual development. Doing all that good stuff is easier if you're in a microsystem that has multiple dyadic relationships and the adults get along with each other and support each other. So Bronfenbrenner says we all need somebody else, maybe three or four somebody else's, who pick up the slack when we get tired, when we run out of gas. Two or three or four or five adults, maybe some teenagers around, the child can go to when it has a question, and not everybody has to deal with all of the questions. Somebody, after all, has to do the dishes and you can't spend your time constantly with the child and feel like you're keeping the microsystem pattern flowing smoothly. But it helps if you have other people who can do that, who also like the child. Whether it's child care, maybe we all should be privileged to have nannies, maybe three or four adults, grandparents, aunts and uncles, little sisters, little brothers, people who come in and share these parenting responsibilities with us, and who share the values. And so if we're going to set limits of a particular sort, everybody understands that, which means you have to have communication among the people. So you have to have dyadic relationships with all of the people in the child's life, and I think that's probably the next proposition. Ah, it is. So instead of saying it, I'll show it. All of that works better if there's lots of communication. So you want the dyadic relationships within the microsystem to involve a lot of communication and discussion about child rearing, about what the child is doing, about what everybody else is doing with the child. And that becomes part of the parental dyad, that you take child rearing seriously and you talk about it and you think about it and you read about it and you learn about it as the child is growing. To develop the mutual accommodation and the mutual trust among the adults so that they can take care of the needs of the child and parent the child appropriately. I left an N out someplace there. In contemporary societies, have all these different settings. And once a child gets into child care, you're communicating across a mesosystem. So you can think about all of the mesosystem principles and hypotheses as helping in the parent process. And I'll stop there and we'll go on both with Bronfenbrenner and Galinsky on Wednesday.